The Water Quality Supply and Treatment Subcommittee will now come to order. Missy, will you please call the roll?
Chair Stevenson is excused. Representative Maggard?
Here.
Ranking Member Hart? Representative Altman? Representative Basabe?
Here.
Representative Bell? Representative Brackett? Representative Cassell? Representative Cross?
Here.
Representative Dunkley?
Here.
Representative Gonzalez-Pittman?
Present.
Representative Gossett-Sidman?
Here.
Representative Henson?
Here.
Representative Oberdorf?
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Temple? Representative Waldron?
Here.
Representative Yeager?
Here.
Thank you, Missy. Before we begin, please make sure all electronic devices are turned off and placed in silent mode. Good afternoon, members. Today, the meeting is an opportunity for us to begin the learning about PFAS. PFAS has a large class of complex human-made chemicals that have been used in a wide range of consumer and industrial products, including food packaging and the formulation of fire suppressant foams. While PFAS are no longer manufactured in the United States, they were extensively used and manufactured beginning in the 1940s. Efforts to investigate and understand PFAS and the potential risks to our ecology and human health are still going on. I look forward to today's presentation and discussion. Our first presenter will be Dr. Christopher Tief. If I said that wrong, I apologize. Hazard Substance and Waste Management Research. Please come up.
I should work from here?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
And make sure your mic's on. There it is.
Thank you. I regret that I'll miss Chair Stevenson and Ranking Member Hart, but thank you very much, Representative Magda, for inviting me. And also thank you to Gene Curtin for coordinating it. My name is Chris Tief. Not only am I the Director of Toxicology for the company that you mentioned, Hazardous Substance and Waste Management Research, but I've been on the faculty at Florida State for over 40 years. Had the opportunity to see a lot of different things, and I want to give you my perspective on the perfluorinated substances and the polyfluorinated substances today. But I want to start out by saying that as a group of toxicologists and geologists and engineers and regulators, we've never seen a group of substances like the fluorinated compounds. We used to think that arsenic was the worst thing we'd seen, or we used to think that it was ethylene dibromide or benzene. Nothing like these substances, as you'll see as I'm working my way through this. So I want to leave you with that, because that means that we have to either soften our expectations or we have to come up with some new ways to address some of these things. So the first question, and I think you started to deal with it, Vice Chair, is what are perfluorinated and polyfluorinated substances? And there are two. People say PFAS as though it were a thing. It's about 7,000 things, and that's not an exaggeration. As I'll go through these, I'll mention a half a dozen or 10 in a couple of instances as those which we know the most about, but we have a challenge ahead of us with regard to the family of chemicals in general. They have, as a important feature, a very strong carbon to fluorine bond, which is what drives a lot of the physical chemical properties and ultimately some of the toxicology as well. As I said, there are somewhere between 6,000 and 7,000 that we know of, but there are probably more, and we'll find those as we go. They have variable properties that relate to their individual structures, but by general statement, I would say that they are soluble in water, which is an interesting problem in its own right. They're extremely soluble for the most part in water, which makes it difficult to deal with. They're also dispersive. They travel through the environment relatively easily on various environmental media or through environmental media. They're mobile. They're persistent. Again, that relates to this fluorine to carbon bond. If we keep coming back to that, it's because that's really the driver here for these substances. And finally, they're bioaccumulative. That's, again, a physical chemical property that will differ with the substance. But by and large, they're bioaccumulative, and that creates some interesting problems for us. PFOA, perfluorooctanoic acid, and perfluorosulfonic acid are the most studied, but there are many others for which we're gathering some information. You'll see as we go through this and as you hear from others that the shorter chain compounds, we have come to call them Gen X as though they were a thing. They're not. There are a variety of different substances which are smaller molecular weight, shorter chain. They act differently. They're in some ways easier, in some ways more difficult to deal with. And there has, as you heard, a wide variety of industrial and commercial uses and sources that have been generated over the years. The most interesting ones are the ones I've listed here. They're by no means the only ones. Water repellent clothing and footwear, the hiking boots that you buy, if they're waterproof, they had PFAS in them. Nonstick cookware, if you go to the Publix housewares aisle and look at the little tiny frying pans on there that use to cook individual eggs, they now say in a sticker, PFOA free or PFA free. That's because they weren't always. These have very interesting properties, one of which is that they're very resistant to sticking. And that's why food packaging also finds that PFAS have an application there. Cosmetics, because of the way in which they need to be applied, this physical chemical properties of the PFAS cause them to be attractive. And then finally, this relates to the environmental release possibilities. We tend to think of environmental release as being some sort of a dumping activity or some sort of an illicit activity, but in the case of the PFAS, it's largely because of how broadly they were used. People will say, well, where are they? Yeah, you talked to me about boots and raincoats and nonstick cookware. Where are they out in the environment? Well, you should ask yourself this question. Where aren't they? They're everywhere. The Arctic, the Antarctic, the bottom of the ocean, the Marianas Trench, the deepest part of the ocean, our drinking water in some instances, bottled water in some instances, our food in some instances, and in fact, on top of Mount Everest, PFAS have been detected. And that can be a couple of things. It can be environmental transport from China or Tibet or Nepal or other countries nearby where industrial processes use these, or it can be the fact that there are so many climbers on Mount Everest that are using so much highly sophisticated equipment that requires that it be water resistant and waterproof. So they are literally everywhere. We care about exposure and health effects. There are regulatory aspects of this as well, which you'll hear about later on. But from a health and an environmental standpoint, we haven't ever seen a group or a group of compounds like this. General statements are difficult to make because of the number of substances and the fact that they differ somewhat in structure, depending upon the carbon chain length, and depending upon what other things they have attached to them besides fluorine. But it's really the fluorine to carbon bond that drives most of these physical chemical properties. We also know that partly because of the number of substances that we're considering, but partly because of their chemistry, extrapolation from animal studies to humans, which we often use in toxicology to set regulatory criteria, are difficult. The half-lives differ across the spectrum of PFAS. The water solubility differs. The half-lives differ by species, by strain, by age, by sex. So all of the things that we often get to consider as only being a single property for a chemical substance, we have a large breadth of different types of things that we need to consider. There are various approaches to the toxicity assessment that have been employed. People have used additive approaches where we look at how much do we know about how many chemicals and can we add that information together to come up with a reasonable criterion to match. They have used relative potency frameworks to the extent we know that information. We have used toxic equivalency factors, trying to relate these things to one another. They all have their limits, but they are all used to some extent in the scientific literature, in the research literature, and in the regulatory literature. The draft EPA maximum contaminant level, what's called the MCL, the guidance suggests that we should deal with PFOA and PFOS as individual substances, and that the other four that they have judged there to be enough information on can be dealt with in what's called a hazard index approach. That is an aggregate approach for the group. So you'll hear both of those as you learn more about the PFAS, that there are both regulatory approaches based on individual chemicals and those that are based on groups of chemicals. We don't really have that many other substances where that's true either. We tend to want to deal with substances one by one, but we can't do that with these. An exposure assessment, the kind of thing that I need to consider, will differ on the circumstances. You know about fire training areas and the fact that these things were used in fire-fighting foams, which means that airports and fire training areas that are separate from airports have a big concern about this. Not surprising, but really does touch a lot of different facilities. They're common in textiles as a result of the need to have water repellency and durability of the fabrics. Wastewater treatment plants are an interesting area because most of what we deal with as domestic customers or as commercial customers goes to the wastewater treatment plants. It then gets treated to the extent you can for the things that we can treat. PFAs are not well treated by wastewater treatment plants. And so therefore they are often discharged from the plants or they get discharged to the land in the form of the sludges that are removed from wastewater treatment plants. So it's a little bit like the cat in the hat. We started out with a little tiny spot of green snow, and by the time we were done trying to clean it up, all the snow was green. So that's what we face with the PFAs. They are incredibly ubiquitous. Well, they are ubiquitous, which is incredibly common. The public impacts so far to date have primarily emphasized groundwater and surface water. There's not a big air issue with the PFAs because of their physical chemical properties. But again, dealing with groundwater and surface water and potentially soils is another that can affect either one of these is going to be a tremendous challenge, the likes of which we haven't faced before. It doesn't mean that the agencies that are out there at the federal and the state level haven't been working hard at this. The Food and Drug Administration has been working for about a dozen years on food testing and dietary exposure considerations. There are now 16 PFAs that are in food testing processes. That normally would seem like a lot until you know that there are 6,500 or 7,000 of them. So we have a lot of work to do, but we deal with it as best we can with the information that we have. They have assessed the following: dairy, produce, meats, and grains. And they have concluded, at least to this point, that PFOA, PFOS, FNA, HXS, and PFBS, perfluorobutane sulfonic acid, don't represent a human health concern from the diet at this point. These things are all subject to revision as we learn more, but that's at least a starting point. Doesn't mean they're not of interest toxicologically from other set sources of exposure, but at least from the diet, it appears as though these are limited in their contribution. This is reflected also in the fact that if we look at human blood values that are generated, which we know surprisingly a good deal of information about, it appears that blood values are declining over time. And that's a function not only of our recognition that these are problems, but also differences in the way people address their food supply and their drinking water and that type of thing. So that's the good news, I suppose, if I have any for you today. So I'll read the title for you. Locally caught freshwater fish across the United States are likely a significant source of exposure to PFOS and other perfluorinated compounds. I don't know if we saw this one coming. It's probably not terribly surprising, but it's another aspect of the food supply that we probably need to take into consideration. And it also speaks to the environmental breadth of exposure to the PFAs. Some recent research from the federal agencies, and I'll touch on a couple of my experiences with DEP, although they'll be able to speak in much greater detail to that. People are working very hard on the PFAs at the moment. 2021, the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry put out a report, a toxicological profile, in which they developed minimal risk levels for, again, the common ones that we see. PFOA, PFOS, hexane sulfonic acid, and nonanoic acid. These are intermediate values. They generated these evaluations relatively quickly based on the information that was available. There's probably 10 times as much information now as there was in 2020 or 2021 when they were developing these recommendations. There is the open literature. Just one example, Paper and Toxics by Penny Airy looked at the current knowledge. That's how it was reflected. Well, that was 2022. That's not the current knowledge anymore. It's changing so rapidly. There was a large human cohort study, exposure study, done in 2022, published in Environmental Research. They indicated there was no overall increased risk of cancer in that study that they looked at. That isn't totally consistent with what we're seeing in animal studies. Bless you. And then there are industry and commercial aspects of this as well. The Alliance for Risk Assessment is a well-experienced organization that proposed some acceptable levels that I'll mention to you in a minute. So there's a wide variety of activities going on, not only at the regulatory level, but at the regulated community level as well. And then finally, I mentioned the freshwater fish study that has identified them. I think that will not be the last that we will see, and there may be more out there that I did not identify, but that's a pretty recent one. What we often have to contend with in dealing with individual substances is the cancer risks, if they have them, versus the non-cancer risks. Most substances, if they are carcinogenic, also have a criterion that's available for non-carcinogenic effects as well. We have found that in most of the substances we deal with, the guideline values, the health-based criteria that we generate, are usually more restrictive for the carcinogenic properties than they are for the non-cancer properties. That's not true for some of the PFOAs, or from the PFAs. So like PFOA and PFOS don't have much in the way of carcinogenesis data, but they have very restrictive criteria for non-carcinogenic endpoints, to the point where it doesn't even matter what the carcinogenic values are. The non-carc values are so low that you're already at a point where you may not be able to achieve those either from a detectability standpoint or for a remediation standpoint. In 2023, EPA put out proposed reference doses, the non-carcinogenic criteria. They're out there. 10 to the minus eighth milligrams per kilogram per day. That's the hundredths of millions of a milligram per kilogram per day. These are extremely low numbers. We can't meet them in a lot of instances, but human beings show a remarkable degree of resiliency, and we may find ways to be able to detect these as we go along. They also proposed in 2023 that perfluorooctanoic acid was suggestive with regard to carcinogenic potential. It's been proposed to change that criterion to likely, and we'll see if that occurs. 2023, that group that I mentioned, the Alliance for Risk Assessment, put out proposed criteria for exposure that were similar to, but somewhat less restrictive than the EPA's criteria. Not so surprising, but at the same time, the numbers didn't vary all that much. 2023, the International Agency for Research on Cancer. This isn't just us. This is a worldwide phenomenon. We just happen to live here, and so we get a much greater flavor of it more quickly. They judged that to be a PFOA to be a possible carcinogen. That's sort of an intermediate category, but it will certainly gather additional scrutiny as time goes on. And then the agency, the American Conference of Governmental Industrial Hygienists, an occupational safety and health group, generated a recommendation that it be called a confirmed animal but unknown human carcinogen. So we're gathering our information. We're getting better information. At the moment, what's interesting about it, I think you should take away, is that the non-carcinogenic criteria are so low that it's likely they won't be trumped by the carcinogenic criteria, which is a very unusual set of circumstances. If we look at individual existing regulations and guidelines, there's no final MCL for any of the PFAs. No final drinking water standard is out there yet. And as I'll mention, maybe if I remember a little bit later, the interesting part about MCLs is they have a toxicity-based component where the generation of a value for protection of human health is inherent to the process. But they also have, and that's where the MCLG, the maximum contaminant level goal, is typically generated. They also have a requirement from a variety of different pieces of federal legislation that they consider cost and technical feasibility. And we may find ourselves with the PFAs in that world relatively quickly, given the kind of criteria that are being generated by the health calculations. In June 2022, EPA put out a lifetime drinking water health advisory, again, an advisory value, not a regulation. And in 2022, they had reduced it from 70 parts per trillion. We don't even have very many substances that have anything parts per trillion. But they reduced it to 0.004 parts per trillion, which is 4 parts per quadrillion. We have no substance that's regulated at that level at this time. The most restrictive criteria that are out there that we know about, for the most part, are the dioxins, and they're not even this restrictive. So that tells you kind of where we are in the overall scheme of things, both now from a tox and health standpoint, but also from a technical feasibility standpoint, what we face. The Gen X compounds I mentioned, the shorter chain compounds, have less restrictive criteria, 10 parts per trillion, still a pretty low number. And in DEP's provisional groundwater cleanup target levels, they are in 2022 put out the drinking water health advisory values that have been placed in force by EPA. But I know that you'll hear more about that later on today and where that's likely to go. California, which we often look at as kind of a bellwether state for really, really restrictive criteria, has also put out preliminary health goals of 7 parts per quadrillion, 0.007 parts per trillion. Again, we've never seen anything like this, and it's going to really put us in an interesting situation for the next number of years. Recent actions by EPA, they proposed to the Office of Management and Budget, those two common ones that we know the most about, PFOA and PFOS, be designated as hazardous substances under CERCLA. That's a big deal. That affects a lot of people in a lot of different ways, from a chemical management standpoint to a chemical disposal standpoint to a site investigation standpoint. In 2022, they had some additional reports that came out. There was a draft report from the Science Advisory Board and the review panel. And then interim and final health advisories were issued in June of 2022. That's about a year and a half ago. In March of this year, there were new proposed national primary drinking water regulations for PFOS, PFNA, PFHXS, Gen X. PFOAs was 4 parts per quadrillion, 0.004 nanograms per liter, parts per trillion. Really, really small numbers. It irritates me when people do this, but I'm about to do it. What does that mean? What kind of a concentration does that mean? That means a drop of water in a cube of water that is the height of the Empire State Building on each side. It's real small. It's really small. And that really, really creates some functional and practical problems for us in detectability and management and remediation and site investigation and all those types of things that we normally take for granted. Very recently, it's become somewhat common knowledge that the PFAs may soon be regulated under TSCA, which has huge repercussions. It was bad when they were listed under CERCLA with respect to the additional requirements that may adhere to that. But at the same time, listing it as a toxic substance under TSCA really ups the ante quite a bit. And that's at the federal level. So just when you think it was bad, it's worse. Now here's a monkey wrench for you. PFAs are detectable in rainwater around the world at levels that exceed drinking water criteria. So what that raises from a practical person's perspective is, so I have a site and I don't have any reason to think that I have PFAs that have been discharged at that site or that I've used them for anything at that site, but for some reason or another, I'm crazy enough to sample the soil or the groundwater and I find them. Historically, what that means is you were using them and you didn't know it, or you were using it and you lied to us, or some such thing. But now the real question is, maybe I didn't do any of those things. Maybe it's a rainfall-related consideration, which is going to have, again, repercussions that we've never seen before in terms of achievability of targets, how you establish what a site is and isn't. Can the detection limits that we have available to us now distinguish between actual disposal at a site or use at a site and careless use versus what may have come down in the form of rainfall to that site? I wish I had a constructive suggestion for you there. I don't at the moment. We'll have to work on that. With respect to funding, you can, those of you who are in the legislative arena know that it's all about what can we do with what we have. And in March of 2023, the White House put out a report on PFAS, and they specifically cite the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act and the Inflation Reduction Act as potential funding sources for kinds of responses that are almost certainly going to be required that will be partly health-based and partly technology and regulatory limitations-based as we go forward. So in summary, PFAS, as with many substances, have the potential to cause adverse health effects, environmental health effects. The difficulty relates to setting levels in the way that we normally have done so, such that we acknowledge the uncertainty and we look at the animal data and we divide by 1,000 to make sure we're protective of the human population. In the case of the PFAS, we really can't do that yet. It's not possible to do it yet, partly because of the uncertainty, partly because of the number of substances we have to deal with, and the fact that people deal or they express comments about the PFAS as though they were a thing. They're not a thing. There are many different things that we're going to ultimately have to contend with. The agencies have taken an increasingly aggressive approach, partly because they're being forced to, and partly because they recognize the need that we often have to get ahead of these things as best we can, as early as we can. Let's learn as much as we can and decide what else is it that we need to know and then try to gather that information as well. There's a massive assessment, characterization, and risk evaluation effort underway now at the federal and in some instances at the state level. And that's going to get more aggressive as time goes on. We're going to spend more time and effort trying to decide what's an acceptable level of exposure to these things. Those of you who are in the legal field, and I know there are some either in front of me or behind me, there's large multi-district litigation that's currently housed in South Carolina, but it has many Florida firms in it. And there are likely to be more of these. So we need to be aware that those things, those activities are often judged by what the regulatory standards are. And so some of the uncertainty that we face in generating those kinds of standards based on the limitation of information we have are going to put those types of activities, these very large litigation activities, in a difficult place. So stay tuned. It's complicated. It's going to stay like that for a while. I know that there will be questions. I'll be happy to stay here for a little bit or let the next speaker speak, and then we'll have questions, whatever your preference is, sir.
Thank you, Dr. Teeth. I think I want to thank you for that presentation. Wow. Members, are there any questions? Wow. Okay. Just about everybody. Mrs. Representative Cross.
May I?
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And may I ask a series of questions?
Yes.
Thank you.
Do I get to say anything about that?
So this is really hard information to hear, and I think a lot of us knew that these were bad, but maybe not as bad as we're hearing today. You kind of alluded to the fact that these chemicals are not in production anymore. First of all, is that true?
I'm not the person to ask about that. I've heard both sides of that. I don't know that they're being manufactured in the United States. I believe they're still being used in the United States. Those are kind of two different things. But many of the facilities that historically did manufacture them or use them are some of the highest profile remediation sites that we're going to deal with.
Okay. If these are still in use in the United States, I'm assuming this would probably require federal law to have some type of prohibition. Is that correct?
Again, it sounds like that, but I'm not a lawyer, and I would hesitate to answer that question. I don't know what the tools are that are available to regulators or to legislators in that regard.
Okay. And just a final question, some of the substances that are replacing these, do we know anything about whether those are in fact potentially more dangerous?
I don't. I haven't seen much about that. But I'm certain that that's going to be a focus of whatever is being proposed to be used. Where's the data that tells me that's any better than what you just finished using? They were very effective. They were very broadly used for decades and decades. And we're facing the penalties of that now. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Overdorf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you're looking at four parts per quadrillion as far as a potential level, is there readily available equipment that can even measure that?
It's sort of been a research exercise. So there are methods that can achieve those kinds of detection limits, but not on a commercially available basis. That is, not on a level that you could hire Spectrum Labs and have them go out and achieve four parts per quadrillion. The numbers that you were achieving now are considerably higher than that, and they're getting better at it, but it's they're chasing a moving target.
Just following up on that, so when we're looking at the overall ability then to deal with this in a regulatory standpoint, and I'm looking at cleanups or those types of things, well, I think what I'm hearing from you is that this standard is beyond achievable, if you will, even for to get to those and beyond an achievable, measurable moment to say that, yes, I'm at four parts per quadrillion.
I think that's fair to say right now. You may find that we get into an iterative approach with regard to investigation and remediation where we do the best we can with what we have in terms of detectability and remediation strategies, but they may find themselves back in the field again when those approaches are improved.
And the final, my final question then would be, if this is potentially a non-achievable level, in your professional opinion, do you think the guidelines should be modified to an actual achievable level?
Well, it isn't necessarily that you would modify the health-based approach that's used, but because both the state and the federal government have the ability to deal with cost and technical feasibility in developing standards. So there's guidelines and there's standards. The guidelines are what we would hope we could achieve and may eventually be able to achieve. The standards are those which are legally applicable and required to be achieved, as you know. But there are differences that are not always appreciated by the general public.
Representative Henson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation. It's a little scary.
To me as well.
Has PFAS, is that the way you say it?
PFAS is fine.
PFAS has been discovered in the groundwater of Lowell, Florida, and Marion County.
I don't know about that specific case, no ma'am.
And how would I find that out?
My first call would be to the county environmental department, and they can tell you whether there are sites that are currently under investigation in that county. They may direct you to or lead you to call DEP as well, but I think that would be a joint call. It would be a two-pronged approach. That's how I would go about it.
So if I discover that it is indeed PFAS, because there is something, there is something, I just don't know what it is, and if it's this, it's scary. How would it get removed, or can it be removed?
There are approaches and engineering approaches to removal down to certain levels of control. But as I said, part of this is going to be a challenge to our skills and the tools that we have. We can't probably meet four parts per quadrillion in terms of remediation at the present time, at least for not a, and not for any reasonable cost. Maybe if you had an infinite amount of money, you could, but that's not the way it works. And so there are aspects of it that would be limited by the engineering or the technical laboratory capabilities, and there are parts of it that are going to be limited by dollars. But first of all, you got to understand whether it's there or not, and what the distribution of it is. Any sites that I've dealt with that have remediation strategies, they all start with an investigation that seeks to determine the distribution and the magnitude of the contamination. Mm. That's going to be hard with these substances.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Gossett-Seidman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the summary, you state that agencies have taken an increasingly aggressive approach from environmental and health perspective. Are you able to speak to what agencies and what would be driving those?
Well, certainly EPA and the analog at the state levels, as they've learned more and more about this, they've taken the responsible view that they have a requirement to at least investigate the situation. I think you'll hear later about what tools we have available to do that at the state level. A lot of states are looking to EPA, but as I said, my own personal view is that if you give somebody, if someone calls you and says, what number should I use, and you give them a number that's not achievable by anybody anywhere, I don't know how helpful that is. So I think you're going to find that these evaluations that are being done now on a health basis are going to form the floor, and then we're going to have to work upwards from that in terms of what we can achieve and what we can detect, for that matter. It's not just the achievability and the removal capacity. It's can I even detect it reproducibly?
Thank you very much.
Yes, ma'am.
Again, thank you, Dr. Teef, for being here today, and we appreciate your presentation. It's very thorough and eye-opening.
Thank you. Appreciate
it. I'm sorry. One of them are representative.
Thank you. Three quick questions.
Yes, sir.
One, what is the biochemical process that causes cancer, theoretically, from these substances?
I'm pretty sure that's not known. We can know that it has the capability to cause things that we recognize as cancer in animal studies. Mm-hmm. The day that we can detect what specific biochemical changes cause cancer, we're going to be way ahead of the game. That's not known to my knowledge.
But it has been determined that it does cause cancer.
In some animal studies.
In animal studies.
At relatively high doses. But that's the limitation of our toxicological understanding
right.
at the moment.
What is the process that a PFAS chemical is manufactured? How is it produced?
Wrong guy.
Okay. All right. And is it all man-made, or is any of it occur naturally?
I've seen that question answered lamely before. I don't believe I've seen anything that says that it's naturally occurring, that these substances are naturally occurring. Doesn't mean they can't be found in nature, as I mentioned from this precipitation issue, but that's because their origin was man-made.
Thank you again for Dr.
Thanks.
For being here. Next, I'd like to welcome back Jessica Kramer, the Deputy Secretary of Regulation Programs of the Florida Department of Environmental Protection. Ms. Kramer will explain the regulatory landscape and its relates to PFAS at the federal and state level. Mrs. Kramer, you're recognized.
Thanks so much. I think I'm going to just question for you on navigating to another presentation. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Oh, on the left.
I'm going to rely on what he said, not my area.
My sincerest apologies for that. Thanks so much for having me back. It's good to see everyone again. So the first couple of slides are a little bit of an overview of PFAS, but given the great deep dive that we just got from Dr. Teef, I'm going to just touch on that briefly and then dive right into the regulatory framework. As we've been discussing already, PFAS, per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, are a large class of man-made, traditionally man-made chemicals that can occur in the environment. And what I'm going to talk to you a little bit about today is both actions that EPA has been taking and also actions that we at DEP have been taking to address these contaminants. So I'm going to go over, some of this is going to be a little bit repetitive of what Dr. Teef talked about, but I think it's important to start with some of these higher level pieces that show a little bit of the foundation of how we've gotten to where we are at FDEP. One of the processes that's required under the Safe Drinking Water Act at the federal level is called the Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring Rule. UCMR is what we refer to it as, and it happens every 5 years, and each new year gets a number added to the end of it. So from 2013 to 2015, we were in the sampling process of UCMR3. Now, this was the first sampling process for drinking water coming out of certain drinking water systems across the country that required monitoring for both PFOA and PFOS, two of those are the substances that we know more about than kind of the other in that robust class of chemicals. There were three Florida public water systems that tested above the health advisory level, that 70 parts per trillion that Dr. Teef had talked about, that was issued by EPA in 2016. And where we had those systems test above the 70 parts per trillion, they took actions to address those contaminants after receiving those results. Anything with an asterisk by it is how I'm trying to denote between an EPA and a DEP action. And so moving into 2016, DEP's site investigation section began to investigate across the state certain types of facilities to determine what the sources of PFAS were that potentially caused the contamination in those three drinking water systems. We identified a number of the source areas as being related to the use of AFFF, aqueous firefighting foam, that firefighting foam that Dr. Teef talked about. And, of course, this is a known source of PFOA and PFOS. We also took additional steps, and I've got a slide here that walks through a chart of the different sources that we've investigated, but we also looked into dry cleaning sites that are in the state's dry cleaning solvent cleanup program. We inventoried these sites and conducted samples also at landfills and plating facilities and some other chemical manufacturers. And I'm going to talk about what we did where we found PFAS above those health advisory levels here in just a second. Before I do that, though, I want to talk about what we did in 2018, which is we developed provisional groundwater and soil cleanup target levels. I'm not going to use the acronym because it doesn't flow off the tongue, but I am going to just call them our cleanup target levels as we move forward. So as you'll see for groundwater, we utilized that 70 parts per trillion health advisory level that had been established by EPA. And in soil, we had additional values that were determined. And so again, these were the provisional cleanup target levels that we established in 2018. This is the chart that I was referencing that talks about the different types of facilities that we looked at, the different studies that we did. And it's a little bit dense. I'm not gonna talk you through all of it at this point. I think you have it available. But needless to say, we started to look at a universe of different sites. What we found was that there were a number of these different types of sites that had groundwater samples above the provisional cleanup target levels. Where we had those sites that had groundwater that tested for PFOA or PFOS, or the combination of the two, above 70 parts per trillion, we started to utilize a standardized process to address those impacts. So what we did is we would coordinate with DOH, and we're still doing this process today. But the main thing we were looking at is ensuring that there weren't drinking water impacts, folks weren't drinking the water that was testing above 70 parts per trillion. And so what we did was reached out to DOH, and DOH would go out and would look at a half-mile radius around the source that we were inspecting. They would identify any private groundwater drinking wells, private wells that were accessing groundwater for drinking, for consumption. And to the extent that within that half-mile radius, there were additional hits above that 70 parts per trillion at any of those wells, that circumference out around that site would grow until we didn't see them anymore. to the extent that there were private drinking water wells that also hit above the 70 parts per trillion. And again, this is still going on today, so I don't mean to only talk about it in the past tense, but our water supply restoration program supplies those citizens that are drinking that water with alternative sources of drinking water at no cost to the citizen until a permanent solution can be achieved, such as hooking up to a municipal drinking water system. So jumping back into that timeline of the federal and state landscape, in 2021, EPA published UCMR 5. Again, remember, this is that testing required under the Safe Drinking Water Act. This time, because in that testing, EPA can identify up to 30 contaminants that they can require the systems, certain categories of systems across the country to sample at. This time, EPA required sampling of 29 different kinds of PFAS and lithium. I'm going to talk about that a little bit more, too, but I'm going to just keep going through the chronology here for another second. In June of 2022, EPA issued those interim health advisory levels that Dr. Teef was talking about, with particular interest to the PFOA level set and in the parts per quadrillion, which, again, we had never seen before. Certainly posed a lot of questions with something being put out below detect. I think Representative Overdorf, to your point before, but there were the interim levels put out for PFOA and PFOS. In July of 2022, DEP, again denoted by the asterisk, had statute that was passed by the legislature indicating that if EPA has not finalized their drinking water standard, that maximum contaminant level Dr. Teef referenced, by January 1st of 2025, if they have finalized it by then, we will adopt the rule statewide. And if not, then we will go through our process to adopt our own rules and our own levels. I believe that I said that correctly, so I just wanted to make sure I got it right. And then the last thing on this slide is in August of 2022 is when EPA proposed designation of PFOA and PFOS as hazardous substances under the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, also known as CERCLA, also commonly referred to as the Superfund Law. In March of 2023, EPA proposed their MCLs for PFOA, PFOS, and then the five additional, which have that hazard index, again, that Dr. Teef so eloquently described. And coming into January of 2023, remember I talked about that UCMR 5 rounded testing with 29 PFAS and lithium. So there's a gap between when it's published and when the testing starts. Testing started in January of this year. And EPA has indicated that they're going to release the data because the data becomes publicly available on a quarterly basis, and they will release it in 12 tranches of those that quarterly data. The first release of data was in August. We just had the second release of data in November. This slide walks through a list of what we have seen in the tranches of data that have come out through the UCMR testings. Now, importantly, I want to just draw the distinction that what you have right now in UCMR 5 testing, that initial UCMR 3 was held against the 70 parts per trillion. As these new tranches of information are coming out from UCMR 5, what you're seeing in terms of levels that this is being held against in as people look at it is the minimum reporting level, which is 0.4 parts per trillion, I believe, and then also, which is also the proposed MCL. And so it's a different number. It's looking at a different number than that 70 parts per trillion that it was analyzed as when we were in UCMR 5. If there is a sample result that comes back by the water system that's above that minimum reporting level, in this case, the proposed MCL, there are public notification requirements in addition to just the information being rolled out by EPA in those tranches of data. Moving forward, there are a host of things that we are going to continue to do here at DEP. We are still actively working on site assessments. There are a couple of cases, as I understand it, where we are actually starting to do source removal. So we've identified a source of PFAS at a site that we can go in and actually remove and hope to get the bulk of it out, stop environmental impacts. But we are also going to continue to work through the process that we've been using with DOH to address potential impacts to private water, private drinking water wells accessing groundwater across the state. We are keeping a keen eye on the forthcoming federal actions, the federal legislation that we expect to come down the pipe, obviously, as we've been directed to do by statute, but also ensuring that, we can communicate and answer questions to the public and the regulated community alike as those actions come forth. Engagement with stakeholders, it's very important for us to understand how things are going to impact, for example, the drinking water sector as these proposed regulations turn to final. So we are committed to continuing to engage in stakeholder continue with stakeholder engagement. And the last thing that I want to mention is our commitment to ensuring that we're using good risk communication. I think what we've heard from Dr. Teef, kind of the illustration that comes to my mind from that, is that there is a lot of information out there. It's hard to process sometimes. And it comes with different numbers that don't always make a lot of sense. And so it is extremely important to us that we are communicating appropriately about the information that we have. And not only that, but what does it mean? Because without bridging that gap, we're leaving folks in a place where they're not entirely sure, and we certainly don't want to be doing that. Thank you for having me. That's the end of my presentation.
Thank you, Mrs. Kramer. Any questions from the committee? Representative Henson.
Thank you for the presentation, Ms. Kramer. We know that there is contaminated groundwater in Lowell, where the largest women's prison in the nation is, at the Florida Women's Reception Center, the Marion Boys Correctional Center, and a small township called Lowell. Have you done any site testing there to see if there's PFAS? Have you done any remediation there? Please help me understand what's going on in that community that I represent.
Go ahead.
So I would have to look, and what I would like to do is look at what we're doing in that area and get back to you on that, because I don't know off the top of my head what sites would be around that area that we may have looked into.
Thank you.
Representative Cross.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you explain what, and first of all, thank you for updating us on DEP's efforts. Can you explain what source removal has been looking like in your efforts thus far?
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I'm happy to do that. So let me give you an example where you perhaps have a site that has barrels of chemicals that have been stored that are leaching out a material that has PFAS in it. That is a source we can go and remove. That's a lot. That's something that is you can kind of identify it. You can see exactly where it's come from. To Dr. Teef's point, there is some of it that we can't, you know, you don't necessarily know exactly where it's coming from, but where we have the opportunity to see it and go out and remove it, those are the types of actions that we're taking.
One more.
And thank you. I guess this is just a comment. As we go forward and see what's coming from EPA and from your agency, I would just encourage everyone involved in this to help continue to educate us. This is going to be kind of a triage situation where we have source removal and in places where it's easy to identify sources, plus we're going to have extensive work we're going to have to do at the municipal level in potentially upgrading our wastewater treatment plants. So just being able to help inform us and maybe direct the legislature where we can best focus our policy and our funding efforts.
Thank you. Representative Yeager.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you help me just kind of get an update where we stand mitigation on the Orangewood water system in Holiday? That's in my district. I know we had some stuff. I was kind of getting an update where we stand and what the effects of that are. And it's the mitigation of it, right, now that it's been discovered.
Go ahead.
So let me touch on that at a high level and then tell you I'm going to get back to you with more details on it. I can tell you we're actively coordinating with the system. As soon as we saw those results come out, the system, I think, had already been kind of on top of it, which was great. And so we are coordinating to ensure that we can provide assistance in the ways that we can and to make sure that the impacts are being addressed. And so I'll follow up with you, though, on some more detailed information.
Thank you. Representative Altman.
What is the status of the science for testing humans that have been exposed? Is there an actual process of testing humans to see if they have a level of PFAS?
Recognize.
So, again, at a high level, I can speak to that in terms of the ability to test to see if it's in humans' blood. Beyond that, though, I can tell you that I don't have the expertise in that area, so I apologize.
Thank you. I do have one question. So we can treat and measure 70 parts per trillion, but we can't do 4 yet. Is that correct?
My understanding is that 4 is the level by which underneath it we cannot detect.
We can get to 4.
So in terms of treatment, I would want to get back to you on that.
Thank you very much. Is there any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much for your presentation, Mrs. Kramer, and thank you for the insight.
Thank you.
I want to thank the committee members today. I want to thank our presenters. Very informative. Give us a lot to think about. Members, this concludes our committee agenda. Seeing no further business before the committee, Representative Yeager moves we rise. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned.